It's Monday, May 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, Baghdad teeters on edge as Iraq plunges into political chaos.
Someone's going to have to sit down at a table and arrive at an understanding about what Syria is going to be.
The top U.S. diplomat is in Geneva to seek stronger peace efforts in Syria. Also ahead, curbing Asian demand for ivory. Another big vote looms for Republican presidential candidates. And Beyoncé serves some musical lemonade. It's all on today's International Edition. Baghdad teetered on the edge of political chaos Sunday. The city is in a state of emergency. Protesters have occupied parts of the once secured international zone. Lawmakers have run away, and the military is on high alert. Early Sunday, protesters led by Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr gathered in front of the country's now empty parliament before moving into what is known as the zone's Celebration Square. By Sunday evening, the protesters temporarily ended their demonstration and started to withdraw from the area. A statement from Sadr's office said the move was made out of respect for a major Shiite pilgrimage. The parliament takeover was the culmination of weeks of political wrangling and increasing instability, and came just days after U.S. Vice President Joe Biden visited Baghdad to show support for a government battling Islamic State amid political and economic crisis.
He and the Prime Minister putting together a new cabinet, and I'm having meetings today. Had a meeting with the Prime Minister and now the Speaker to talk about the progress we're making against Daesh. It's real, it's serious, and it's committed. And we've talked about, we will be talking about a number of things, but in my last meeting with the Prime Minister, we talked about the plans that are in store for Mosul and the coordination going on with all of our friends here. And so I'm very optimistic.
In Erbil, VOA correspondent Sharon Bain describes the groundswell of unrest that has been building in Iraq.
There's actually been weeks of protests, and this actually started last year. There is a massive swelling, a groundswell among the population of grievance against the government. They find it completely corrupt and they're lacking basic services. And there has been a groundswell of opposition to the government because they failed to reform the system. In his defense, Prime Minister Abadi has said that he has not been able to reform it because the political blocs inside parliament don't want to lose their power. But so there's been this groundswell of opposition in the general population. And Muqtada al-Sadr has managed to use that to his advantage and say he now represents, you know, the voice of the people. And it's given him an incredible power on the street. So with one speech, he can actually gather thousands of people behind him. And, you know, this is the first time that protesters have actually been able to come in and actually do sit-ins. They did this, but this is a large sit-in inside the international zone, where the foreign embassies are and where the ministers have their homes. So this is quite dramatic. I think there's a lot of tension right now in the city. From the people I'm speaking to, there's quite a lot of tension in the city, but no one is quite sure what's going to happen next.
Lawmakers fled Saturday after protesters stormed into the parliament. Some 60 lawmakers, mostly from the minority Kurdish and Sunni parties, fled to the northern autonomous Kurdish region. Officials said thousands of protesters were in the so-called international zone, parked outside of major government buildings. Normally, only those with special badges are allowed into the secured area, which is also home to many foreign embassies and the United Nations. Well, we turn our attention now to Washington, D.C. proper, where the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner took place last night. Gee, Abby Lee is here with us to tell us the social media snippets from the gala that we affectionately call Nerd Prom.
We do. Hi, Jim.
Hello, G.
I didn't have to use the hashtags to find that the numerous posts about the dinner on my Facebook and Twitter feeds, and needless to say, I was very green with envy. But if your feed is not inundated with pictures and tweets from that dinner, you can use hashtag WHCD or hashtag NerdProm to find out more.
Well, that's great. We're all about being nerdy here in the Capitol.
We are.
I'm sure this kept the White House social media team very busy this weekend.
Indeed. Neither the White House at White House nor President Obama at POTUS live tweeted the event, but the social media team had a bigger fish to fry, and that fish was in the form of the funniest video many people have seen from the White House. The White House tweeted, "Watch POTUS in Couch Commander." It's a comic description of President Obama's last few months at the White House as a quote-unquote lame duck commander-in-chief. It also shared a video on Facebook.
Well, going back to the dinner, what did people have to say about it on social media?
Mostly positive things from what I can gather, but at the same time, it might be worthwhile noting that President Obama has always been popular among the younger generations, many of whom are more active on social media than, let's say, baby boomers or older. Many social media users commented they like the fact that Mr. Obama doesn't take himself too seriously.
Any controversies?
There always is. First Lady Michelle Obama's dress was widely talked about. She wore a dress custom made by the Italian design house Givenchy. And many fashion magazines wrote she looked fantastic, but some people criticized her for wearing a designer dress. She didn't get the note about wearing a Target dress. Last but not least, comedian Larry Wilmore is also trending. He spoke at the dinner, and now he's in the hot seat for using some derogatory remarks as part of the joke. That's all for me today, Jim.
Well, thank you for that entertaining wrap-up, G. She tweets for our program's account at VOA_IE. She has her own account as well, at G. Abby Lee. And you can also follow me out there on Twitter at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA's International Edition. We check now some of the top stories trending in Asia. The U.S. discloses senior officials sold nuclear secrets to China. Rare rallies in Vietnam held over mysterious mass fish deaths. China blocks U.S. Navy ships' access to Hong Kong port. Islamic State claims killing of Hindu in Bangladesh. And International Workers' Day is marked across Asia. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are trending right now on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The Giants Club Summit in Kenya focused on what African countries can do to stop elephant poaching, but that's only half the battle. Lenny Ruvaga spoke to the Asia representative of the World Wildlife Fund about what must be done to stop demand and international trafficking in ivory.
Rain pounded the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, for close to 3 hours Saturday. However, it did not dampen the mood of conservationists and international organizations that had gathered to witness one of the largest ivory burns on the African continent. At around 3 p.m. East African time, 105 tons of ivory stacked up in 11 pyres was lit up in a symbolic move by Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta and Gabon's President Ali Bongo Ondimo. The tusks from 8,500 elephants marked the culmination of a call by African leaders, including Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni, to end the illegal trade in ivory. Conservationists were torn on which side of the debate to cast their weight. However, those in support of the ban expressed support only if it would end the trade in illegal ivory. Jean-Pai Ongsiwirithaya, the policy advocacy specialist in Asia for the WWF, noted that the organization stood in solidarity of the burn only if it would curb the trade.
The only reason that we support the burning or the destructions of the ivory stockpile, it's only if the government keep use this as an opportunity to send to the public, send to the criminals that they are serious and has zero tolerance to the illegal ivory trade, to the poaching of elephants. That is the only reason why we're supporting it.
Last August, Thailand destroyed over 2 tons of elephant tusks, curved ivory and trinkets, most of it from elephants poached from the African continent. Thailand passed several new regulations in an effort to shut down its national ivory market. The government also made African elephants a protected species and further co-sponsored a historic United Nations General Assembly resolution to address illegal wildlife trade. A WWF campaign dubbed Chor Changru last January condemned the killing of elephants for ivory by symbolically removing the letter Chor Chang from their names. The Thai word for elephant is Chang, and it starts with a letter in the Thai alphabet called Chor. When learning the alphabet or spelling words with this symbol, it's referred to as Chor Chang, and it is a common letter in the Thai alphabet similar to E for elephant. Speaking to VOA, Ong Siriwitaya pointed out that the country has passed a number of laws to crack down on the illegal ivory trade. But the biggest asset, according to her, is public support.
First, we're advocating with the public to understand the issues of illegal ivory trade as a transnational crime. Both, it's similar to drugs, similar to illicit arms that coming across African continent, passing through Asia and coming to Thailand, both as a transit and as the end destination.
Asia has been the largest destination for ivory from around the world, with the Kenyan port of Mombasa being a key transit point. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has arrived in Geneva as part of a U.S. bid to reaffirm a U.S.-Russian mediated ceasefire as violence escalates in Syria, especially in its largest city, Aleppo. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said airstrikes Saturday continued to take a heavy toll on civilians in the city, where activists say nearly 250 people have been killed in the past 10 days. On Sunday, the group said 859 civilians had been among the more than 3,000 people documented killed in the conflict during the month of April. Proximity talks to end the five-year-old conflict on the ground ground to a halt last week. And before the talks, Kerry told the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee that a partitioned Syria would not be out of the question should peace talks ultimately fail.
Someone's going to have to sit down at a table and arrive at an understanding about what Syria is going to be. But it may be too late to keep it as a whole Syria if we wait much longer. So that's what's at issue here. I'm not going to vouch for this. I'm not going to say this process is sure to work, because I don't know. But I know that this is the best way to try to end the war, and it's the only alternative available to us if indeed we're going to have a political settlement.
In Geneva, Kerry's efforts will be complicated because Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is not scheduled to be there. During his 20-hour visit, Kerry is to meet with the foreign ministers of Jordan and Saudi Arabia. The road to the White House swings through the Midwest state of Indiana, and that turns out to be a pivotal contest among Republican candidates, as we're now joined by VOA Senate correspondent Mike Bowman with details.
Indiana is perhaps the knife's edge on which Donald Trump's quest to win the Republican presidential nomination outright is sort of teetering on. The conventional wisdom was, about a month ago, that he was going to have trouble pulling together the 1,237 delegates that he would need. However, he won his home state of New York. He swept all five Northeastern primaries, Mid-Atlantic Northeastern primaries last week. And there is a new poll out showing him with a 15 percentage point lead in Indiana. If that holds up, he will be on a path, not necessarily a glide path, but certainly a path where 1,237 delegates is very much within his reach.
It seems that the Republican establishment, if you will, has pretty much come to terms that Donald Trump will likely be the nominee for the party. However, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, and Texas Senator Ted Cruz had made this pact about a week ago to try to stop Trump from getting as many delegates as he needs to win a first-round ballot and possibly then take the ballot on a second round, one of the other two. And so this is the state where Kasich allegedly agreed to just kind of back off and let Cruz go head-to-head against Trump.
Indeed. And even with that pact, and no one really could see how that would work very well. But even with that pact and Kasich sort of letting Cruz have a free hand in Indiana, Cruz, according to the latest polling data, is trailing Trump by a significant margin. And this strategy of denying Trump the nomination by preventing him from winning it outright in a first round and then locking up the loyalty of all the delegates, that only works if you prevent Trump from getting 1,237 in the first round. And as inconceivable as that might have seemed a year ago or even just a few months ago, he is marching towards that very possibility.
And to help him out, he picked Carly Fiorina as a vice presidential running mate, something that's almost unheard of at this point in the process.
You know, putting the cart in front of the horse. I don't know. This seems to be putting an entire wagon train in front of a horse. Yes, Ted Cruz decided that he would name his running mate before he's even secured the nomination. And when he's won only about half the delegates that he would need for the nomination, with only a few states left to go, I do see the logic in it. Carly Fiorina is from California. She ran in a Senate race. She was beaten rather soundly, but she does strike a lot of the conservative themes. And if you are looking for any possible edge that you could possibly get going towards the end of the nominating process, well, California is the biggest state in the nation. It is the biggest delegate prize out there, and it's one of the last remaining states. And if Ted Cruz thinks that Carly Fiorina can give him some sort of edge in California, and that edge might deny Trump the 1,237 delegates, then I suppose it's a Hail Mary worth taking.
Your perch on Capitol Hill in the Senate gives us great perspective on what is happening in politics. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure.
Visit voanews.com for more on this story and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Superstar entertainer Beyoncé released her latest album, Lemonade, in quite a unique way. First, it was on HBO as something called a video artwork, and then it was only available on the download site Tidal. But it's still expected to debut at number one on the Billboard album sales chart this week. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the album, its visuals, and its unique way of being released.
No one had any idea what this Lemonade thing was. We didn't know, was it going to be an album? Was she, you know, was this a movie? What is she doing exactly? So, like millions of others who had to decide between going to see Purple Rain in honor of Prince, who had just passed away, or sitting in front of the television and watching HBO, I chose to check out Lemonade. So as it turns out, Lemonade is a visual album. It was being promoted as a visual album. So it included a number of songs, new songs, that eventually made it onto an audio album. But they had these very beautiful, stunning visuals around it. So it was like one long music video, an hour-long music video made up of, I think there were about eight or nine shorter music videos. Now, those of us who are also interested in the business aspect of this, because, of course, Beyoncé is probably one of the best marketeers around. She did this to us before with Beyoncé, her self-titled album, just dropping it in the middle of the night. And, you know, if you weren't on Instagram at that moment, you had no idea until the next day. She kind of did the same thing. But this time, as you say, she released it on HBO. It went away, and then it pops up, surprisingly, but not, on Tidal, which happens to be her husband's streaming service. And then slowly they rolled it out onto iTunes. And I assume at some point you will also be able to purchase a hard copy of this album as well. But this was Beyoncé's new album.
Now, the number one question, how's the music?
It's very different. It's really interesting. It's very different. Now, I don't think that we can really talk about this without, unfortunately, talking about the theme or some of the themes. There's a lot, especially in the beginning, that implies, a lot of the lyrics imply that she and Jay-Z in the past, maybe in the present, who knows, went through a really rough time, and that there were some accusations of infidelity, kind of, if you sort of, you don't even have to read between the lines. She just came right out and said it. So there's a lot of that. It's a very personal album, I think, we think. And then it's about, you know, being angry. It's about being hurt. It's about redemption. It's about coming out of that and becoming a bigger, better, more powerful woman. So it's a powerful album lyrically. Musically, it's all over the place. She managed to make it work, and I'm hearing some really good things about it. I've not experienced it as an album. I've only experienced it as a video piece, but you know, this weekend I'm gonna put my headphones on. I don't think any man around wants to hear it, but I'm gonna put my headphones on and take a listen and see what it sounds like. But I you know, kudos to Beyoncé. I mean, she's got us talking, and I think, you know, she put together, at least visually, a very stunning, brilliant piece of work.
All right. Well, what do you think? Have you heard Lemonade, or did you see the HBO special? Send us a tweet. You can send it to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. You can send one to us. We're at VOA underscore IE. Or you can log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
You've been listening to International Edition. For Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Xiaogang Chong, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the 2015 country reports on human rights practices issued by the State Department in mid-April, Russia's authoritarian government continues to commit and ignore numerous human rights violations. First, citizens' right to choose their leadership in free and fair elections was consistently restricted through the government's efforts to suppress dissent. New and existing repressive laws were used to harass, discredit, and punish individuals and organizations that criticized the government. The government particularly targeted those who spoke up in support of the government of Ukraine or opposed the Russian government's activities in Ukraine. Further, the Russian government continued to selectively prosecute racial, ethnic, religious, and sexual minorities and migrant workers. In addition, officials denied due process to defendants in politically motivated cases. The government used secret detentions and convictions based on questionable treason and espionage charges, and even tried and convicted non-Russian citizens taken illegally from other countries, especially Ukraine. Yet at the same time, authorities failed to bring to justice individuals responsible for the deaths of prominent journalists, activists, whistleblowers, and opposition politicians. Indeed, Russia's support of separatists in eastern Ukraine and its two-year occupation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula were responsible for some of the worst human rights abuses in the region. According to international monitors and human rights NGOs, the combined Russian separatist forces in the Donbas region and the Russian occupation authorities in Crimea caused thousands of civilian deaths and injuries. Russian occupation authorities in Crimea cracked down on members of certain groups, in particular Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars, who spoke out in opposition to the occupation. And finally, conflict in northern Caucasus between government forces, insurgents, Islamist militants, and criminal forces led to numerous human rights abuses and a general degradation in the rule of law. Such abuses imperil the future of Russia and its people. In the words of Secretary of State John Kerry, a government that fails to respect human rights, no matter how lofty its pretensions, has very little to boast about, to teach, and very little indeed in the way of reaching its full potential.